Managing Director of Emerging Markets in Africa and the Dean of the Deloitte Alchemy School of Management. Martin, welcome back to the show. How are you this morning?
I'm very good, Suba. How are you today?
All the better for speaking to you, and also all the better for now knowing that, I don't know, what was the city before? Was it Mumbai? But Shanghai is now the priciest city in the world.
Yeah, quite staggering. So it just talks to the extremely rapid recovery from COVID-19 that Asia has, what's the word, enjoyed or experienced. So now the top 10 global, a report came out last week, Friday, found that of top 10 global cities in the world, the top three are in, actually top four out of top five are in Asia. It reads Shanghai, Tokyo, Hong Kong, Monaco, and then Taipei in Taiwan. And it's Shanghai is staggering in terms of the increase in prices in the last year. It also talks to the strong currency. But we're seeing globally, just some comparative indicators here, the collapse of tourism resulted in a 9.3% plunge in the price of a hotel last year. Business class plane tickets became 11% more expensive. However, in what we're seeing in China specifically, we've seen some staggering increases where plane tickets are up 82% in prices compared to last year. I talked to the accumulation of wealth, of course, growing demand, people not wanting to sit in economy class and can afford to sit in business class itself. So it's actually quite amazing. What you've seen here is also that this has been quite an anomaly, and even hotel prices went up 15% in Shanghai alone. So clearly the luxury lifestyle in Asia has bounced back significantly, and even the Julius Baer, the Global Wealth and Lifestyle Report, which did this research, has changed the categories from personal trainers, wedding banquets, Botox and pianos, which are normal indicators of so-called wealth, to the new ones, bikes, treadmills, health insurance, and a technology package. So I'm not sure where you fit into the category, but this is how new wealth has been indicated or measured in Asia. And the rise in expenses and wealth in China specifically, and Shanghai very specifically, has been staggering to say the least.
Look, I can't keep up. So, I wouldn't be able to keep up with those numbers. So I can't even say I fall into one of those categories. But I suppose shows like Bling Empire and movies like Crazy Rich Asians, I mean, they've been speaking to this, for, you know, bringing that perspective into the mainstream, how, you know, just massive that wealth is. The other thing that I think I saw over the week, last week, is that the largest, I think Forbes released that the largest number of billionaires officially now exists and resides in China, whereas before it was, I think, in the United States.
My 12-year-old daughter bought the Crazy Rich Asians book last week, in fact, from exclusive book. And she's seen the movie, now she wants to read the book. And she went to Singapore on vacation a few years ago. So she totally gets it, but it just tells an incredible story of wealth that is largely family-driven, often. And Asia's success is going to be dependent on how the next generation maintains that wealth.
Also a powerful story, I think, Martin, if you can give me some your thoughts on this, but a very powerful story about how appropriately run state-led growth does ultimately, I mean, this is far better than any private sector trickle down, right? Mm. So state-led growth that actually does emanate in such a way that it actually empowers the masses.
It's two things, very generically. It's where the state is the entrepreneur in many of these Asian country cases. And secondly, it's the unleashing at the same time, being a state, being an entrepreneur, unleashes the power of private capital. And we see this incredible and very tech-savvy populations and societies, incredibly sort of tech-driven, high-growth savings culture, high investment culture, and of course, extremely hard work in the process. That's underwritten Asia's success for the last generation or two.
True. Also a testament to the state, I have to say. Impressive. What is this, 2 decades? Sorry, I'm sitting here like lamenting, like what could my life look like if I had the right government? Let's turn our attention to Japanese firms that are not feeling too great about an international expansion.
This is somewhat problematic. Japanese firms, of course, are at the best of times quite conservative. And what we've seen is that there's been a report released by JETRO, the Japanese External Trade Organization, surveyed 13,000 Japanese companies in the last quarter, and found that almost 70% of them are very concerned and are starting to pull back on their international expansion strategies. sales of Japanese firms globally were down 38.4% during the COVID period in 2020. And this has resulted in an increase in aversion, should we say, to international expansion strategies. Now, I've seen this to an extent amongst many Japanese companies in our region, that it's not about so much expansion as it is about withdrawing to an extent or consolidating domestic market. And of course, they have very much of a risk-on attitude, Japanese companies, thinking about trade protectionism, rise of China, conflict potential in Asia, across the Taiwan Straits and Southeast Asia potentially. So kind of a risk-on mentality, despite the relatively positive state of the Japanese economy, and certainly Asia as discussed, they still have this risk-on mentality, very different to what we're seeing in the U.S. arguably right now.
Very interesting stuff. Risk-on is the way forward, particularly coming out of a pandemic. Great positioning there. Back to China, a very interesting story about this $2.75 billion fine on Alibaba for anti-monopolistic or antitrust practice. Mm.
I'm not sure if you've been following the news, but Jack Ma, the iconic founder, one of the world's greatest entrepreneurs, has been in trouble in China recent times. Since the end of last year, he was very critical of banking legislation, of a regulator, indirectly of the state, and there's some very powerful political forces in China have rallied against Alibaba and Jack Ma particularly. This is now ongoing and resulted in a $2.75 billion fine, as you mentioned, for anti-monopoly violations announced on Saturday, a couple of days ago. And it's been announced by the China State Administration for Market Regulation, SAMR, and allegedly for it determined that Alibaba has been abusing its market dominance, which certainly is dominant, the last 6 years by preventing its merchants from using other online e-commerce platforms. It said that it goes on to say that the practice violates China's anti-monopoly law by hindering the free circulation of goods and infringing on the business interests of merchants. So this was expected in recent weeks by analysts, questioned how big the fine would be, and it's been the biggest ever. But in a very disturbingly, if you know, Jack Ma famously was refused access despite applying many times to Harvard Business School.
Yes.
And what do you do if you're a billionaire? Well, Jack Ma started his own business school. He invested $29 million in a campus in his hometown. And it's called Hupan. It's become one of the leading business schools in China purely for entrepreneurship. And he even teaches at the school. And concerningly, the Chinese authorities in recent weeks have now stopped new students from enrolling in the school. And this is quite concerning. It just talks to sort of the sort of personal clampdown and sort of one could use it with vindictiveness potentially against Jack Ma going forward. And this is quite concerning, not just from a shareholder's perspective, but just generally. I mean, there's almost a concern in China amongst leading entrepreneurs. It comes back to your comment of the role of the state. When does the state regulate? When does it be business friendly? And that balance in China is always a political play. And we're seeing that now with Jack Ma and Alibaba.
It certainly is. I'm glad you led with the theory behind it, because that's exactly why I found the story so interesting. It's not necessarily a country that I would think is necessarily against monopoly kind of business practices, actually, particularly if, as you were saying earlier, the state is the entrepreneur. And it's frustrating. I mean, look, Jack Ma, for all intents and purposes, has done nothing wrong except to be critical, which is a huge cultural lashing that he's getting for that.
It's the rules of the game in China. Then you can make money, make as much money as you can, or you're able to. But ultimately, it comes down to not be critical of the state, and even in ways that are indirect. And what we've seen since 2013 is an increased intolerance of dissent from the business sector in China. So of course, high growth and the economic management model that China has does at times come at a potential cost.
I'd never make it, Martin? as a business person there, not being critical of the state. Thank you so much for those insights. Dr. Martin Davies joins us every other week talking emerging economies, specifically on Asia. He is the Managing Director of Emerging Markets and Africa and Dean of Deloitte Alchemy School of Management. Personally, I would sooner go to Jack Ma's business school than Harvard Business School, which is now a swill of anyone who can pay whatever they can.